So last week I argued that it's a very useful skill to understand the relationship between causality and probability, especially in the context of research design, which is what this course is about. If I were to give it an English name, I would just call it research design. So that was the first thing. Then I said that probabilistic relations originate from the causal structure. So if we have a causal graph, we can actually predict, we can figure out which things are going to be dependent and independent. I showed you a number of examples with the software, we played with it. I introduced the examples in order to tell you about three important rules of the relationship between causality and probability. I have kind of explained them, gave examples. So what I will do is now I will introduce these rules again. On the slides, I introduce another example of a causal graph. I forgot how far I went, but I don't think I went terribly far to the very end of the presentation. So you remember the important things about the example and other examples was that causal graphs are subjective to a large degree. They are essentially what is in a researcher's head. That may be worrying to you, but I assure you that science is to a large degree, doing science is to a large degree subjective. A scientist decides what to look at, how to measure things, and these are decisions in a scientist's head. So also what to include, so where the boundaries of that thing are. Everything is connected to everything in the world, but you decide, well, here is where I'm going to stop, and I'm going to be looking at the subset. So I made some jokes like knife. I added knife to that, just to demonstrate that idea. Again, the units, you could measure glass by the number of glass shards per square meter, but you could just say glass, no glass, right? It's a decision that you make. If you look at data, somebody who collected the data made those decisions for you. And because of, from the graph, we can read which things are going to be dependent or independent. The three rules that I mentioned were the following. Oh, they are flowing from a theoretical assumption that is known as causal Markov condition. It's an axiom, an assumption, but it looks like it's quite likely true in the world. I don't think there are many counterexamples, and those that there are, I think they can be explained away. I don't think I have seen a convincing counterexample to that condition. It's a theoretical condition, but we will not get into the theory in graphs. We'll just look at the consequences. So the first one, there are three rules only, was that a chain makes things dependent. I'm not speaking very clearly because I had a procedure done in my gums and still I feel a little bit sore there, so I guess the shape of my tongue is not what it should be. So a chain of influences makes things dependent on the chain. If you remember, we were also breaking those chains by observing, conditioning on variables. Common causes make things dependent. It's the second rule, like here. And you've seen examples of that on the slides. And the third one, the hardest, I guess, that's why it was so late analyzed, is that if you condition on a common effect, then the causes become dependent. That's an interesting thing. We've known for centuries that if you condition on something, then you can make things independent. Remember, we looked at age of a child, then the shoe size and the reading ability become independent. That has been known for centuries, really. People were doing this, controlling for things. But this hasn't been really widely used and understood until 50 years ago or so, which is quite recent. And then the three rules summarized. Again, you can get the slides from the web, so I'm not going to stop here for long. The conditioning, screening off once again, it will break all the connections from the glass, thorns, and nails to the effects of a flat tire when you condition on flat tire. It will also make the descendants independent because you are conditioning on a common cause. Again, you break that dependence. And then, of course, it will make dependent the three causes of flat tire. Somewhere here we stopped, I think. This slide, did you see that slide?
Can you show another next slide? Because more?
It was
no.
You didn't, okay. So maybe this was one of the last. We are taking a side step. So we talked so far about causal graphs and dependencies. Now we are going to take a side step, which is important because you will see the mechanism used in designing experiments. It's an important side step. So they have proposed, these are philosophers, but very computational philosophers from Carnegie Mellon. They proposed a theorem, actually they proved the theorem, very easy to prove from the Markov condition, that if you have a causal graph, which means if you have an understanding of something, and that's what we have, we understand systems, we've learned that over our lifetime, so we understand how things work. If you have a causal graph like that, then you can predict the effects of manipulation. Manipulation is different from observation. It's a very different operation. If you can predict it in the following way. You just modify the conditional probability distribution of the variable that you have manipulated. If you manipulate perfectly, then the other causes of that variable become irrelevant. They don't work anymore. You intervene. You manipulate. Here is a good example. It comes from a book, Looking Dark at the World, Black Humor, Dark Humor, it's called in English, Dark Humor. In Polish, it's Czarny Humor. And one of the jokes was the following. There was a samurai committing suicide with the short sword, wakizashi, cutting his belly, and then realizing, oh, I had cancer tumor. Why is this joke relevant? You know, there are many causes of death. He could have had cancer. He could have had maybe HIV infection, AIDS, maybe COVID, maybe the tumor spread to his brain. I mean, there are many causes of dying. He manipulates with his life. He's killing himself. At this point, he's half dead already. He will die within, actually, they usually cut their head off. A second colleague would cut his head off, so he would be dead in a moment. And the other causes of death, flu, AIDS, cancer, they become irrelevant, right? That's why he's so jolly, you know, he has avoided dying of cancer. So that's why I showed you that joke. Not a very nice joke, but dark humor. Look in our graph. It's different to observe flat tire from putting a knife in the tire and cutting it. How is it different? If you observe flat tire, well, that will still make tell you something about the thorns, nails, glass on the road. Yes, flat tire, oh, something must have caused it. Those causes become more likely. If you manipulate, you take a knife and cut the tire, the other causes are irrelevant. It doesn't matter how many glass shards were there on the road, it's irrelevant. They are no longer working. But the rest of the graph is still there, and you can make predictions of the effect of that manipulation based on the rest of the graph, right? That's a nice thing, because if we have understanding of something, and then we can predict what will happen if we manipulate. We just have that understanding. That understanding is not changing. We can just see what happens down the stream in terms of the causal graph. Very nice property. But the important thing here, from the point of view of research design, is the irrelevance of other causes. That's important, and we'll get to that in a couple of slides. Empirical research is concerned with testing causal hypotheses. Usually we start with an observation of correlation. That's the way we work, the scientists work. There's a problem, like women are dying of the it's cervical cancer. Cervix is the beginning of the uterus. And then we realize, oh boy, and that was observed, I think, in 19th century, it looks like nuns are almost never getting cervical cancer. Prostitutes are getting a lot of it. Oh, that's interesting, right? So there is a correlation between probably behavior of those women and cervical cancer. What kind of behavior? Well, prostitution, it's probably having intercourse with many partners. So maybe many partners are correlated with the cervical cancer, right? And then we are digging deeper, of course. But we start with observations of some dependence. Then we formulate hypotheses. At some point, they formulated the hypothesis that maybe very intimate contact spreads some bacteria or viruses. They didn't see any bacteria, so viruses. You could see bacteria under a microscope, but not viruses, right? And then they postulated that this is practically a venereal disease where there is spread of a virus. We know today it's HPV virus. Just several months ago, there was a campaign encouraging young people, children, to be vaccinated against them. Still a Russian roulette, because you vaccinate against the most popular strains. It covers, I think, 70% of the strains. So even if you have a vaccine, I would not advise to act recklessly in terms of contact, intimate contact. Anyway, we observe correlations. So, like in the case of smoking, they noticed a few centuries ago that people who smoke, because smoking is a habit that I think dates back to the discovery of Americas. We brought back the tobacco. Maybe it became very popular, I don't know, 19th century, where they had cigarettes, they started smoking. They noticed that people in the cancer wards that have problems with their lungs, lung cancer, I think they knew already the concept of cancer, that many of them are smokers. And then among smokers, they noticed that more of them than in the population end up having lung cancer. It's the first observation, a correlation. So now, what do we do with that? Well, first of all, we can think about what does it mean, the correlation between the two. It's not a silly question, because there are important people, scientists, who are doubting all their life about causation in this context. The prominent statistician, Ronald Fisher, whose design you will see in a moment, design of experiments, he was doubting it. I have a quote by him that I will show you in a few weeks from now. So what does it mean? Let's look at three important variables. So smoking, lung cancer, and genetic factors. Genetic factors, it's not really far-fetched, because we know that there are genes that are related to cancer. You could say maybe they are a causal factor in cancer, because genes you are born with them. Maybe there are some mutations, but normally you have them long before you develop cancer. So with time precedence, it cannot be that cancer causes the genes. It's the genes that cause cancer. And when you see them together often, then you suspect that they are causal factors in cancer. We know that today. Smoking and cancer, of course, we'll look at the correlation. Here are a series of graphs. I think I have 9 graphs that explain the correlation. They are possible explanations of the correlation. Genes have nothing to do with cancer and smoking, but smoking causes cancer. Genes influence cancers, but not smoking. Genes influence smoking. That's really not very wild, because we know that we are born with preferences. Some people like sweet food, some people like sour food. Some people like drinking alcohol. We know that there is some genetic factor, not just observation, observing adults, but also some genetic factors. So maybe in smoking too. Some people like the feeling of warm smoke in their lungs, some hate it, dislike it. So it's not far-fetched. This graph, which is, I think, what is happening, actually, I think our knowledge today is quite strongly indicating that smoking is a causal factor in cancer. Why do we suspect smoking? Well, the correlation, but also when we, as scientists, observe the world, then we look at things that are close to each other. They are connected. Smoking brings smoke in your lungs. Well, that's a possible cause. There is no action at a distance without any mechanism, typically, right? We think about extrasensory perception, telecommunication, you know, with our brains, but we still don't understand it well enough to actually admit it as a possibility. Most of the experiments with that failed. People who can do things with their brains claim that negative predisposition of the surrounding disturbs them in doing that. I heard that, and you know, I see some smiles. I don't know really. I think we don't understand enough. I read Klimuszko. He was a famous Polish guy and a priest who apparently was doing amazing things. He was like, based on a photograph, he could help the police in finding the body of a person and telling what happened to that person. You know, we may smile about this, but he did it several times. So there was something. But in experiments, he was claiming that when the audience was very critical, he was not able to do things. So we may smile about it, but frankly, I think we don't understand it well enough. Because there are people who can predict what happened, where the body is. Not only Klimuszko, there are other people who did that. Worldwide, actually, police are sometimes asking those people to help. In any case, four graphs. Here is another graph. Well, common cause, no relation between smoking and cancer. And a series of four graphs that are mirroring the top graphs, but the causation is from cancer to smoking. That's of course possible in terms of explaining the correlation, but what could we tell as a story? Of course, it's a funny story, right? First you smoke and then you get cancer. So that indicates that smoking can be a cause of cancer. But let me give you the following possibility. We are born with lung cancer. And at the age of whatever, 12, 15, 18, we discover when we first smoke a cigarette, oh, that funny itching I had in my lungs goes away when I smoke, right? So then we smoke more and feel better. I don't believe in what I'm saying, but I'm just explaining how this is a possibility, right? You have to admit that possibility as a scientist. You cannot just dismiss it on moral or whatever grounds. It's a possibility. So now what do we do? We need to find out what is happening here. This is a graph that summarizes the nine graphs that you've seen. These are the possible connections. How do we eliminate those connections? If we just observe, there is no way we can eliminate the connections. If we, for example, perform an experiment, like I talked about, remember, intercourse and pregnancy. Suppose I select 2,000 people, and then I need to somehow assign them to the treatment and control groups. I need to tell some of them to smoke, some of them not to smoke. What criteria do I use? Suppose I look at the color of the eyes. Blue eyes, you are a smoker. Brown eyes, you stop smoking, right? If I do that, then my experiment will not be very believable. because the color of the eyes may have something to do with the genetic predisposition to cancer. And who knows, maybe the blue-eyed people that I told to smoke, maybe they are more predisposed to cancer, so whether I tell them to smoke or not doesn't matter, right? The result in which we get more cancers among smokers may be because of the selection criteria. So how do we select them? How do we put them into two different groups? And that's the ingenious idea by Fisher that I don't think he was... I wonder if he was really understanding the irrelevance of the causes of smoking. Maybe he understood it, but didn't draw the graphs, of course. The causal graphs, that's something that is understood in the probabilistic terms later, much later. But look what happened. He proposed that we randomize. So for every person in the study, we just flip a coin. Flip a coin, heads, a smoker. Tails, non-smoker, right? So I do some kind of randomization. Not necessarily with a coin, you can do it with a computer, but do it randomly. Now, I told you that there's a lot of common sense in experiments, informed common sense. And another thing that I might have already said is that you can be criticized for anything. It's like you can go to court and sue somebody for anything. United States is a society where people tend to sue each other. You may remember the woman who sued manufacturer of microwave ovens because she tried to dry her cat in a microwave oven. And there was no warning, don't do that.
I heard his story when a man shot himself.
Shot himself?
Sued himself. He was using a boomerang. And when he dropped it, the backhand hit him in the head or something like that. And he just sued to himself, and he got money from his company for that.
Producing the boomerang?
Yes.
Oh, no, so he must have sued that company.
No.
No?
He sued himself, but the money he...
Od ubezpieczyciela.
Oh, I see. He was insured, yes.
Yes,
okay.
Insured.
I understand. And there was another woman who bought coffee at McDonald's and put it in between her legs when driving, and it spilled, burning her intimate parts. And she sued McDonald's because the coffee was too hot. And if you buy coffee at McDonald's now, in US at least, it's not hot enough. It's just, you know, warm but not very hot. Anyway, you can sue for anything. The same, you can criticize anything. You notice that. You see that in discussions. The best place is to observe politicians. Oh, they criticize each other for whatever reason. Sometimes absurd reasons, sometimes telling not truth, anyway. So, the same principle in science, in experimental science. You write a paper, you describe what you did, and people can criticize you. Oh, look, this you did this wrong, that wrong. So you will always get criticized. The point is, when you write papers, when you do experiments, we know that every experiment, it's a difficult situation. The measurements, the conditions around in your lab, the people who don't follow your instructions, etc. So you can be criticized for anything, and your experiment probably has some holes. We say it in Polish. What do we say there? Or maybe it's English. It's not waterproof anyway. There are some holes. The water is leaking, right? And the idea is that you need to close the big holes. And the small holes, they will always be there. But in this case, somebody can criticize you. Well, the randomization, the flipping of a coin. Maybe it has something to do with cancer, like the blue eyes, right? What would your answer be here? Well, it could be, but you have to do a lot of gymnastics to find a connection between the outcome of a coin flip and cancer, right? That's what you would say. Pretty much the randomization procedure, flipping of a coin, has really nothing to do with cancer. I mean, if you say it has something to do, how? Tell me how, right? Only by magic, which we typically, we exclude magic in science, by definition. The same, I kind of always struggled with this idea that science excludes supernatural things like God. I wonder if it's really excluding a possibility of existence of God, or is it maybe you always try to find a natural explanation of what you see? I don't know. I haven't really settled myself on this issue. In any case, aside from any magic, coin cannot possibly be related to cancer, right? But the coin does something very nice. By being the source of a perfect manipulation in terms of deciding you smoke, you don't smoke, etc., you are making the other causes of smoking irrelevant. Like the samurai, remember? The same idea. The coin decides who is smoking, so genetic factors, even if you are predisposed to smoke or not to smoke, they are not working anymore. Because it was the coin that made you smoke or not smoke. The same, if there was a link from lung cancer to smoking, it's not active anymore. Because the coin decided that you are going to smoke. So now, you see, if I cut those two links, then at the end of the experiment, if there is a relationship between smoking and cancer, so if there is a difference in the smokers group and non-smokers, the only reason why that difference could happen is a direct link from smoking to lung cancer. So in that case, you are justified in saying that smoking causes cancer. Actually, there's more gymnastics in it in statistics. You remember from last week. We set up a null hypothesis saying, no, there is no relation between smoking and lung cancer. We look at the data using a statistical procedure and say, oh boy, if there is no relationship, then these results are surprising to me. And we measure the surprise by the probability of the data, and we say, well, we must reject independence, null hypothesis, based on this experiment. That's the gymnastics we are doing in statistics. But in any case, the correlation, the relation can be through that link only. In the intercourse pregnancy experiment, remember the results was kind of funny. There were 20 pregnancies in intercourse group and 5 pregnancies in the control group. I haven't done a test on that data, but I suspect it would be overwhelmingly telling us that it's very improbable result that you have such a big difference. Null hypothesis would be no relationship between pregnancy and intercourse. Seeing that data, probably you would reject that null hypothesis and have to declare that there is a relationship between the two. So this is the basic architecture of experiments, which is, I think it was an ingenious idea. And this is the way we do experiments almost always, all experiments. Even in the lab that you are, where you are conducting experiments, you will probably do some kind of randomization, and you will have repeat samples and etc. So you will. In the lab, I would probably, I don't know, not necessarily flip a coin. I would say, okay, every second experiment will be my treatment or control, for example, right? Some kind of random, pseudo-random assignment. It doesn't have to be a coin, but it has to be a reasonable assignment of the subjects that you cannot possibly link with the effect variable. That's the trick. So now I'm almost done with these slides. A couple of things that can be very nicely explained with causal graphs. All of you know the concept of placebo effect. What it is that just getting the treatment, whether the treatment is useful or useless, just getting the treatment makes a difference. So if you get a medicine, the fact that you are getting a medicine makes a difference, even if it's just a sugar pill, like sugar coated with some color. It pretends to be a medicine. Just the fact that you get the medicine makes you better. Very strong effect. I'm not saying that that shamans, you know, the different in primitive societies doing dances and putting hands on you, that it does nothing. We don't know. We don't understand it. We know for a fact that there are people who actually can do something to others.
Because they believe.
Pardon?
Because they believe in
That's one possible explanation. But who knows? Maybe there are some waves that are, you know, we don't understand them simply. We don't know what waves. So a scientist who is very skeptical would say what you are saying, essentially. That, you know, it must be a good explanation is that they believe. But I've seen, not, you know, from myself, but I've seen people who were actually doing healing others. Amazing. I don't understand how it happens. We don't understand it. So I'm usually very, I'm respectful to that. I just say I don't know it, how it happened. So anyway, placebo is a very strong effect, and probably a lot of work that is done by shamans, by the kind of medicine people, is placebo. You know, dancing around you makes you feel better, right? Even the behavior of a physician will make you feel better. If a physician is looking at you, giving you attention, talking with you, that will probably be, the effect is going to be better than a physician who is just, you know, looking at you at a case and spending very little time with you. A good physician, I think, should take that into consideration. In any case, the medicine in the Western world, and we are talking about Western science here, is very chemically oriented. So we really want to give a patient a medicine that actually works in a chemical way, not just as a placebo. So in an experiment testing a new medicine, we would like to distinguish between the placebo effect of that medicine and actual chemical working. The way we do it then is we give to all the patients, to the control group and treatment group, we give medicine to all of them. The only difference is that we give sugar pill to the control group and a real medicine to the treatment group. Why do we do that? We want everybody to be treated the same way. We want to exclude the effect that the control group gets nothing, the treatment group gets medicine, and then just the effect of getting something, right? That's the way it works. It will work. We cannot eliminate placebo effect. So we give that to both groups, and we have an alternative path through which the medicine influences healing, but then we can just deduct the effect between the two groups. If there is any difference, then that difference has to be because of the chemical compound that is given, the real treatment. But both groups will be better. We know that, right? Because of the placebo effect. Another thing that that we worry a lot, we will talk about that later in experiments, is subject experimental effects. They are very strong. I think I told you the story about the rats, right? The two types of rats. So that doesn't only work with between people, also with animals, and it also works with devices. So important for you as engineers that you may unconsciously, having good intentions, you may actually read from the scale of your device wrongly just because you know what you want. There's an example of, I forgot the name, I may have told you that also, the guy who wanted to measure the mass of an electron in a lab. I forgot his name, a physicist, famous physicist. Of course, it's a very delicate matter because he had to have some gravitational field that attracts the electron. Electrons very small, very complex devices. And he also had an idea of what that mass is. So what he did is he decalibrated the instrument completely and, like, you know, changed the scale. He performed the entire experiment, of course, thoroughly, reading from the instrument numbers that were decalibrated. He performed the calculation of the mass of the electron, And only at the very, very end, he took a correction for that decalibration. That way he prevented himself from putting his expectations in the result. It's a very strong effect. So the way we can explain that is by a procedure called blinding. Suppose you conduct an experiment in a hospital. You give two different pills, placebo and real pill. And the nurse knows that green is placebo and red is the real medicine. He or she approaching the patient may actually unconsciously treat the treatment and placebo patients differently. Very, very strong effect. He or she will do it unconsciously, but can do it. The best way of dealing with this is to blind. Not really taking the eyes off, but blinding means in experimental design not telling the experimenter what exactly is the treatment. Very often we actually hire people who don't know what the treatment is. Another thing we do is we don't tell the subject what we are looking for. When we have an experiment, we don't tell the subjects what we are after. Sometimes we even mislead them, like in the experiment with the rats. We don't tell them what the real manipulation was here. We'll talk about this more. But here's one way of showing that. When we blind, we manipulate the experimenter. We make the irrelevant the connection from the treatment to the knowledge and then different behavior. Just the last slide. It is a useful tool. Not always will we take the work on showing the causal graph, but it's always good to think about this. When you conduct an experiment that is more complex, that there are more variables involved, draw it and kind of see what is happening there. It's going to be easier to actually draw it, to see what could be possibly happening in your experiments. The model is clearer, easier to comprehend. Whenever we are observing, whenever we are conducting an experiment, we are dealing with data and then probability distribution over that data. A joint distribution, because we have multiple variables. Graphs are a representation of the joint distribution, so it is really very nice a tool. The goal is consistent with the means, because most experiments focus on causation. Causation plus, of course, the numerical magnitude. In engineering experiments, if you have a new type of concrete, anybody working on concrete in this group? I had somebody last year who was actually doing experiments in the lab, your colleague, who wanted to modify the type of concrete, make it stronger or more flexible, whatever the goal was. Of course, in an engineering lab, not only will you claim at the conclusion of the experiment that adding whatever chlorine makes the concrete stronger, but you will also measure how much stronger, of course. But the fundamental thing is that a causation, that doing something will make something better. That's a typical engineering type of experiment. In any case, it's discovering causation. The scope, it's easy to understand the scope of experimental design. Assumptions. Everything that we do is based on some assumptions. As a scientist, you assume things. Of course, it's a very good idea to make it explicit and describe in your paper after the experiment. But when you have a graph, it makes it explicit what you assume away. There are many methods of discovering causation. We will talk about one possibility. Causal discovery from observations, you see that it's quite a cool methodology that is not experimental, so we don't manipulate. We just look at data, and from there we infer causal connections. So it deserves a treatment in statistics. It is actually increasingly being covered, but also in a course like this, I think it's very important because we are talking about causality. If there are any questions, I assume you will just raise the question right away. So I assume that there were not, you didn't have any questions. The next thing we will do is we will go through a whole collection of different designs, experimental designs. Many courses on research design, like this one, focus mainly on those experimental designs. So this is really the core of the course. Often they take examples, they will take a paper, discuss it, what was wrong with the paper, what was good. What I will do maybe at some point, maybe we'll get a paper to kind of discuss a real paper, what was happening in that paper, and what are possibly problems with the design. Experimental designs are architectures of the experiment. And there are, I forgot how many exactly, but it's less than 20, more than 10, less than 20, different designs. You have to keep in mind that the designs have their history. At some point, somebody proposed the design. And there is no guarantee that you will not invent a new experimental design. What does it tell you? It tells you that there is something fundamental working that the fundamental thing is actually making a good argument that here's what I did, here's what I observed, and the only possible explanation of my observation is that X causes Y. And how you do it is a secondary issue. There are many ways of doing this. Each of the designs is essentially a way of demonstrating it, showing that. Each of the designs will have some problems, as you will see. We'll talk about the problems that are possibly with the designs. That will also make you appreciate the dangers of experimentation. And the list of problems is also not complete. That's another thing. It's almost like, remember, all of you took the fundamental tools of a scientist's workbench. You remember, I had, I think, 18 different skills. 18 is just pulled out of my nose, my head, you know, that's what I thought about. There may be more, but I just thought about 18. I think it's a good list. The same here. Don't treat this as, it is in a way a Bible of experimental design, but it's a Bible that can be modified. In science, things can be modified. There's every truth in science, I may have said that, if not, I'm saying that, every truth in science is tentative. Did I say that? No. There's a difference between science and a discipline like religion. There are truths in religion. I bet many of you, maybe all of you, are religious. So you know that there are some truths that are essentially given to us by prophets, by founders of a religion. And there is very little discussion about those truths, right? They are there, and you cannot, if you start questioning them, you are changing your religion, essentially. Science is very different than that. From that. In science, every truth is tentative. Every theory, no matter how beautiful it is, it can be rejected. It will crumble into pieces with one single piece of data, experiment, or something. And that's the power of science, the way we do it in the Western world. By Western world, I mean all science on Earth today, but there were, of course, many approaches to science. It originated in the Western world, that's why. The importance of empirical work, looking at things, and evidence, observation can... the smallest experiment can actually lead to rejection of a theory. So here is the experimental designs. Again, the whole list is not... we know it's not full. There will be new designs proposed later, maybe. But we understand a lot already. We understand a lot in what can go wrong with experiments. And that's the topic of the next, probably two classes today and next class. If we don't finish, then a little bit of the third class. an introduction, just a word of caution, very, very brief, and then I will show you just a list of possible things that can go wrong in an experiment, but I will not talk about it. I will talk about it in the context of different designs. You will see that different designs were fixing problems with the previous designs. So they are more complex, more they are better, more powerful. Although sometimes they are simplifications. And then we'll start today definitely with experimental designs. And there are two other classes, a series of slides, quasi-experimental designs and factorial designs. Here's what picture of how they are related to one another. Experimental designs, by definition, are designs in which you have full control. You can manipulate with something. I suspect that most of your engineering work belongs to that class, because in your lab you can manipulate something and then observe what happens. Quasi-experimental designs are designs in which you don't have full control. So, for example, if you were to conduct an experiment on smoking and lung cancer, you couldn't do it because you would never get a permission to do that. So you don't have a full control over who smokes and who doesn't smoke. You would have to introduce some kind of control, but not perfect. And we will talk about this kind of designs. So ethical, practical considerations make it impossible to manipulate perfectly. As I said, for most of your work, you will probably have experimental designs because in a lab you can fully control the type of concrete that you are composing, right? Sorry for that example. You have to translate it to your field individually. And factorial designs are just an extension of both. Typically, and we talked so far about experiments where we manipulate one thing. Intercourse, no intercourse, smoking, non-smoking, remember? Just one variable. You can also have experiments in which you manipulate two things at the same time. And that's going to be quite common for you, I think, because the type of concrete can go together with the speed of binding or temperature in your lab. Temperature is one variable, that additive is another one. And in each of your individual fields, I bet, you may feel tempted to do multi-factor experiments when you have several variables. The problem there is, of course, big problem. When you have multiple factors, you would love to have 10 factors, of course. With 10 factors, you have, and all of them being binary, yes, no, you have 2 to the power of 10, which is 1,024 different groups, right? Different combinations. And that means that you need a lot of repetitions or many subjects, many repetitions for experiment. So this is the fundamental problem. That's why we try to limit that, but we would love to do multiple factors. So you'll see what we do in that case. Okay. A typical statistical procedure. There are many statistical procedures to help you with making a decision. In case of factorial designs, there is typically only one used, ANOVA, which some of you may have used already. Again, it's a classical statistical significance test that rejects H0, and it's used in factorial designs. That's how you can characterize it. Typically, I talked about it today, we have a problem, something is happening, women are dying of cervical cancer. That's a problem. People, men and women, are dying because of lung cancer. That's a problem. Then we formulate a hypothesis. We look, we have a cup of coffee, a cigarette, look at that and think, what could be happening, right? We formulate a hypothesis, oh, maybe it has to do with smoking, the lung cancer, right? And then we test that hypothesis. So experimentation is testing the hypothesis. Trying to find a good type of concrete, our hypothesis. We add chlorine, sorry, this is probably a silly example. I mean some chemical, we add that, and then we hope that the concrete will become stronger. Why do we hope it? Not just, you know, trying anything. We hope it because somebody somewhere tried that and it worked. Or chlorine worked wonders in another context, right? We have some suspicions. That's why we have intelligent guesses. Hypotheses are intelligent guesses. And then we conduct an experiment. Of course, the guesses have to be intelligent. Why? Because experiments are very expensive. One of the ladies, I don't know if it was you or somebody sitting here in the first class, she said, my experiment takes a year, right? That's not atypical. Experimentation is very, very expensive. All of you probably know it, that it takes time. So we have to be very, very selective in conducting experiments. We should be really doing experiments when we have strong suspicions that something will come out our way, on one hand. On the other hand, we don't use experimentation to obvious things. There are many truths that we know that have never been tested by experiments. You know that, right? And I don't mean religious truths, but just, you know, everyday truths. I know, for example, that if I start insulting you, all of you, you will, if you don't beat me up, you will quarrel with me, or you will go and complain to the dean and the rector, right? I know it. Has it ever been tested? I doubt it. No use of testing, because we know it. It would be really surprising to me that I could do something like that and there would be no reaction, right? There are many truths, and the next slide is really about, one of the next slides. You've seen this slide, so I'm not going to spend time on it. We have correlations, we have suspicions, then we need to do experiments. Here is the slide I mentioned. Experimentation is very, very expensive, and it should not be. When they first started doing that, early 20th century, there was a lot of enthusiasm, you know, oh, we should test this, we should test that. Never been tested, so it's false. There's one anecdotal example that I remember. I took a course from one of my mentors. You've seen his picture in my other course. Adolf Grunbaum, a philosopher. He did work in Nature of Time, Philosophy of Science. Then Freud. And the third big area that he spent time on, years, probably 20 or more years, was philosophy and religion, religion. I don't know what the origin was. I told you that science is subjective. It might have been that when he was a young man, his rabbi told him, Adolf, you are so stupid that nothing will ever come out of you. That probably had a big influence on him becoming a fighting atheist throughout his life. His parents were religious, but he refused to go to synagogue. He just was an atheist. Maybe somewhere something else, but something kind of prompted him to look critically at religion. And he was very critical of every religion. In that, he behaved like a priest, almost. I remember him at a dinner table at my house, because after taking two classes from him, I really was very impressed by him. He was a great philosopher. He died a few years ago. Really great philosopher. I learned so much from him. In any case, at the dinner table, he would tell me, Marek, you will not believe how light you will feel, how good you will feel if you admit the possibility of that there is no God. He sounded like a priest almost. I can imagine a priest telling me, Marek, become, I don't know, Jehovah Witness, because you will not believe how light you will feel because of that, right? Anyway, so we are all humans. He was also a human. In any case, he focused on religion. And then one time, I took his course, seminar on philosophy and religion, and he made a claim. He said, well, Catholics, many of you are Catholics probably, Catholics believe that if you pray to Saint Anthony, you've lost something. If you pray to Saint Anthony, you will find it easier. And he said, where is an experiment, well-controlled experiment, proving that, right? Why am I telling this anecdote? Because I told him, but there are many truths that were never tested by an experiment. Exactly what I told you. There are many truths, And I don't mean religious truths, just everyday truths that we know are true, and we don't conduct experiments because it would be a waste of time. It is expensive. So I told him, well, but there are many truths. And he, Grunbaum, he was a deep thinker that I really admired, but he wasn't very good at the, you know, ping-pong type of fast interactions. He had to think about things. So I came to him during the break, and I told him, I don't know if you understood my point, Dr. Grunbaum, that I said that there are many things that we know, and we just don't care to test. He said, yes, and he actually gave me a very good answer, very impressive. He told me, look, this table is not standing because there are four legs of the table, but there are four, what do you call those little people, the mythical people? Four dwarfs holding it. I understood his point immediately. Essentially, when you make an outrageous claim, a claim that is not, you know, that people will doubt, the burden of proof is on you. Okay? I reported today, for example, that some people can heal others, right? You found it outrageous. And rightly so, right? Because we don't know the mechanism through which that happens. Then you gave another explanation and almost demanded from me the proof. If I were saying, yeah, that is true, you would, many of you would say, oh, prove it to me, right? And rightly so. Of course, we don't do those things in religions, right? We don't do experiments with St. Anthony. Religion has different mechanisms than science. But Western science, the way we practice it, demands, if you are making a claim, if your hypothesis is outrageous or really counterintuitive, or some people will doubt it, then you do an experiment. If nobody doubts it, why would you experiment with it, right? You don't do it because it's too expensive. So you have to be very cautious, very careful when you do experiments. Pick good problems, hypotheses that are not obvious, right? That's what I want to say in this slide. And it's a difficult route because it's all very expensive. It takes time to conduct experiments. Now, this is the promised list of things that can go wrong with experiments. They are divided in two classes. The first class is internal validity. In Polish, I would say wewnętrzna spójność eksperymentu. But in English, they use the word validity. And external validity. So every experiment, you can judge according to these two criteria. The first criterion essentially says the scientist has observed something and claims that observation, the difference between cancer and no cancer, is because of smoking. The question is it really because of smoking? And you see examples that where you can actually doubt whether this was due to the experimental variable. And the second, external validity, zewnętrzna spójność, it's the question, can I generalize it? Can I, of course, I had a group of people, I conducted an experiment, can I generalize it to the outside? To what population can I generalize it? A good example, simple example, I would conduct an experiment on sex and pregnancy in an old people's home. People who are over 60, 70, 80. The result would be no pregnancies at all. Very likely result. Can I generalize it to the whole population? Obviously not, right? My subjects were not representative. That's an example of the generalization. Of course, it's a funny example, but you will see that there are settings, situations where you cannot generalize. And you can criticize based on these things. There are a number of them. 8 internal validity threats. So these are the dangers that can put into question the validity of your experiment. I'm not going to talk about them now, but we'll talk about them in the context of different designs. You'll see how different designs deal with that, how they protect us from them. And there are external validity threats. Again, we are not going to talk about that now, but in the context of experiments. So I just flashed it. We're going to come back to that. Before we start talking about different designs, here is a notation that I'm going to use on slides. I took it from a textbook, thin textbook by Campbell and Stanley, 40 pages, and I remember I paid for that $60, I think, for that book. Wow! It was the highest price per page that I've seen. Luckily, there are, I think you can probably find on the internet, an illegal PDF of that book. I have a few copies in the lab, so if you want, I'll be happy to lend it to you. Thin book, but it used to be a paper that they published as a book. Excellent book, because it just goes through all these designs in a very concise way, explaining what is happening there. So the notation is the following. We are going to use three symbols, X, O, and R. X is treatment. O, probably from outcome, is the measurement, the test that you conduct in your study, the measurement, outcome. R is randomization. We are going to do that from left to right. Like if we write XO means that we first treat and then measure. And if there are multiple groups, we will have multiple lines. So that's the notation. Very simple, you'll get used to it. First, architecture of experiments. Very simple. And probably you use it daily. I would think that you experiment like that daily. Whenever you are in a new situation, you are doing something and looking at the effect. Every time you have a conversation with somebody, you look at that person, you are saying something, and you are observing. If you observe boredom, you think, well, maybe probably it's because I was boring in my words. Right? If you observe anger, oh boy, I probably have hurt that person, right? Simple examples. Try a new type of food and see whether it gives you gases, for example, right? Simple experiment. The main problem with this, of course, you are trying to attribute the effect to the treatment. Simple experiment, you can conduct it you are conducting it probably in many places. And by the way, I should say something that I, when I teach a computer scientist, I sometimes ask, what is the best searching algorithm? You know, when you have a collection of, let's say, numbers, a vector of numbers, what is the best searching algorithm? I'm supposed to search for number 10, for example, in that list. And there are many algorithms. You can do it sequentially, like, you know, look at every one of them. Then the time taken is half on the average of the number of numbers. You can have a binary search where you, if they are sorted, then you look in the middle, and then you eliminate that or that part by comparing that number that you found to the one that you are looking. If this is smaller than what you are looking for, then you have to look in the upper half. And you keep doing this half, half, half until you find it, and the time taken is logarithm of the number. Very, very fast. In any case, there are many searching algorithms. So the question is, what is the best searching algorithm? Students sometimes say, well, it's the binary search, which is the one. The correct answer is, it depends. It depends. We have a computer scientist here. It depends. It's a frustrating answer that we often, interaction with other people, we ask, how do you like it? What do you like? Well, it depends. Frustrating, it tells us nothing. It's a frustrating answer, but it's the correct answer because it depends. If the data are sorted, then the binary search is absolutely the best, right? If they are not sorted, you cannot do it even. But it also depends on the size of your vector. If you are dealing with a lot of items, binary search is wonderful, you know, it's quickly in the logarithm of that number. But what if you have 10 items only? You have to search in 10 items. Binary search takes a little bit of setup, right? And there's some overhead to that dividing in half and so on. it may be not worth it. If you have just 10 items or fewer, then sequential search searches in on the order of half of that, five, is not significantly bigger than logarithm of 10. It is bigger, but not significantly. The overhead may be not worth it, right? So it depends. Now, why am I saying that? In this context, in the designs, what is the best design? It depends, right? Now, this design is very simple. It has many problems, as you will see in a moment. But the nice thing is that we can do it easily, right? I can walk around and experiment. In fact, I experiment all the time, all my life. And you are experimenting too. Very simple design. Many problems. We are not going to talk about this now, later in the context of other designs. There is a joke that I remember from the elementary school, very old joke. A scientist is studying a frog, has big shears, nožice, cuts off one of the front legs and tells the frog, jump. And the frog jumps. It jumped also before that. Cuts the other leg, front leg, jump, jumps. Third, one of the back legs, jump, with difficulty, but it jumps. Cuts the fourth leg, jump, the frog is not jumping. Writes down in his notebook, after amputation of the fourth leg, the frog has lost the sense of hearing. Essentially, the idea, of course, it's a joke, but you see that with this design, there is nothing to compare to, right? So you can have many hypotheses here, and you know, they can be just as good as the one about hearing. The fundamental problem is that you have nothing to compare to. What you would like to is you would like to compare the probability that of your data to the situation where you are not treating, yes? Of course, in many experiments like that, we do have something to compare to. If I talk to you and then look at your face and I see anger, then I guess I'm comparing it to your behavior before that, right? Or to the normal behavior of people in the society. So in a way, this is not this design. In its pure theoretical form, in this design, you have nothing to compare to, right? Essentially, you are treating and then observing. So you cannot even test that inequality here, which that you would like to. This one tells us already, it's the second design, it's more complex, and it we will look at some of the problems with this design. Here is essentially, maybe this is more commonly used than the previous one. Here is the conversation. I'm looking at your face. You are now, you know, jolly and smiling, and I say something, and I see anger, right? Maybe because it was what I said, right? That's I'm attributing the second measurement that it was different because of my to my treatment, to my what I did. I guess it fixes the problem of comparison because I can compare it to the first measurement. But there are many problems with this design still. A whole list, and we are going to talk about them individually. So what are they? History is the first, it's an event that could have happened between the two measurements. So I measure in the beginning, I look at your face, then I do something, I say something, I tell a joke, for example, and then I look again, right? Something could have happened between my looking first and then later. What could have happened? Well, you, while looking at me and listening to the joke, you could have thought about your neighbor this morning who shouted at you or did something to your car, right? I have no idea that you thought about this. The anger that I saw, not terrible anger, but I saw in your eyes that something may be caused by a thought that you have in your head. And I have no way of actually controlling for that, right? This is a far-fetched example, but there are other examples. For example, in the book by Campbell and Stanley, he gives the example of influence an experiment in which you essentially, the treatment is Nazi propaganda in the United States during around the war, before the Second World War and during the war. We could compare it to propaganda of, let's say, Russian agents. We have probably many, many agents that influence the society. They have agents in every country in the world. And they are trying to essentially, influence the society. They are working on the internet as trolls. They are spreading information, false information. The same thing happened in the United States before the Second World War. There's a significant German minority that essentially many of them supported Hitler and were trying to influence the society. And the Americans were falling into that. Let's suppose we have those Russian trolls working from the year, let's say, 1989, and slowly they influence the society. They influence the society in Poland to the point of actually Poland, the rulers of Poland falling into the policy of reset with Russia. You know that, right? If you watch that documentary, Reset, I think it's a great way. They actually nicely pointed out, point by point, the mistakes that were done by the Polish government in the process of reset. And then what happened? If you were to measure the effect of the Russian trolls in Poland between, let's say, 89 and 2024 today, you notice that that propaganda didn't work. We all are very suspicious towards Russia, towards Putin. We support Ukraine, etc., right? Even the people who were resetting now saying, no, there was no reset. You know, we were not doing this. Reset, by the way, is taken off the of the Polish TV website. It's not there. You cannot find it. It's probably still on YouTube. If you cannot find it, I have downloaded it to the disk to make sure that I have it. You can still watch it. The effect of Russian propaganda was negative. The same with the United States. If you look at the difference between 1930 and 1941, let's say, the effect of the German propaganda was negative. But actually, the propaganda was working. But what happened is the France fell. And suddenly people realized, oh boy, those little guys, that little fellow with mustache, he is a dangerous person, right? Because they noticed that France, which had a powerful army, really very large, larger than German army, they just destroyed it within a few weeks. And that was exactly that event that happened between the two measurements. You measure in 1930, 1942, the effect is negative, but it was actually working positive, but there was a history event, fall of France, that changed it. In case of Russians today, the thing was attacking Georgia. Our rulers should have known that already. But then there was attack of Ukraine, taking Crimean Peninsula, 2014, and then attacking Ukraine directly. Right? That's why now we know what Russians are, but the propaganda is still working, right? Just the effect is eliminated by a history event, something that happened between the measurements. And exactly something like that could happen in your experiment. For example, you set up an experiment, you put a concrete mixture, you set the temperature, everything is fine, and a cleaning person comes into the room and says, oh boy, this air is not fresh, opening the windows wide in the middle of the winter for 5 minutes only. That temperature jump suddenly changes the properties of the concrete because the concrete starts, it binds differently, right, than you would like to. And you don't even know about it. Of course, it's a far-fetched example because in a lab, usually you have a lot of control. In experiments in the real world, you have less control. Other examples, you could say that tough international politics like Ronald Reagan led to the fall of Soviet Union. Could have been something else, like their failure in Afghanistan, or economic problems, or other things. Could be also maturation that we are going to talk about in a moment. Suppose I have a wonderful teaching methodology. I introduce it to a class. I do a test of the class, how much they know about the topic, let's say calculus. I have my wonderful teaching methodology, and I measure the effect at the end of the semester by means of an exam. And I notice that the result of the second exam is wonderful. I taught them so much. They knew little, and now they know a lot. One explanation, of course, is that it was my wonderful methodology. But what if the students got hold of my exams from last year, in the middle of the semester, and similar questions, they just did very, very well. So I could have just as well not taught them at all. The performance is much better because they got the old exams, right? That's exactly something that happened in between the measurements. So many examples of that. What else could happen with this experiment? A natural process, they summarize this, they call it maturation. It's a natural process that occurs in a setting. For example, the subjects, human subjects, getting tired, getting hungry, growing older. So something naturally happening. In the context of a school, let's say my wonderful methodology did not take into account that the students were also following physics classes. I teach calculus with my wonderful thing, but they, during their exercises, during the lectures in physics, they are applying calculus a lot, solving problems, and they actually learn a lot in physics, naturally. So whatever I do in my treatment, it doesn't matter, or matters very little. Their performance on the second exam is because of the physics class, which kind of naturally happened during the same time. Suppose I'm having a wonderful, that's actually a good example because we have a lot of trolling on the internet. Suppose I have an action that tries to influence people, like conservative propaganda, criticizing socialism, communism. I want to kind of teach people to be more conservative. And that study takes 10 years. And I notice, yes, 10 years later, they are more conservative than they used to be. So I did it, right? What could happen also? People, as they grow older, they become conservative, more conservative. There's a saying, a statement by, I think, Churchill, who said that people who are young and conservative have no hearts. People who are old and progressive, they have no brains. It's, of course, an ironic statement, but it says something about humans. We are like this. When we are young, we want to change the world. We want to make it a better place. We want the change, we are progressive, we are left-wing, really, naturally. As we grow older, we realize that the world is a complex place. Those simple things that we thought would fix the world are not working. We kind of become a little bit more withholding. Besides, we accumulate wealth. When we were young, we wanted to share everything with people. Whether they are lazy or not, we wanted to share with them. When we grow older, we've worked very hard on the house we have. We are less inclined to share that house with others. I'm not saying everybody, but this is a natural thing that happens. So that is a natural process. This tough in international politics, Ronald Reagan saying that we will be tough on Soviet Union. I think that Trump says that now. Donald Trump says that we'd be tough with them. It could be also essentially maturation because Soviet Union, a communist system is not very efficient in terms of economics. They cannot feed themselves very often. There's a saying, if communism was introduced in sub-Saharan Africa, then quite likely there would be shortage of sand. Somehow they managed to make it so inefficient that, and it's over and over, you know, everywhere they put their hands in, it's an experiment with economics that fails. So Soviet Union may have fallen just because they couldn't feed themselves, by way of speaking, of course, which is a natural process. It lasted already, 50, 60 or 80 years, time to fall apart. Another one, we're almost done with the class, with the time. Suppose you have an experiment in which you want to teach people how to lose weight. You have a wonderful methodology, some therapy or maybe exercise or diet, and you are putting an ad in the newspaper that you are looking for volunteers for a weight control study or weight loss study. Volunteers come, you offer them some payment, the study takes 3 months, let's say. You weigh them at the beginning of the study, and you weigh them at the end of the study. And you observe that your wonderful treatment led to an average 2 kilograms less after 3 months. One way of explaining it is, of course, your wonderful methodology, your wonderful therapy, diet, or exercise. Another would be that the following. It's a natural process for them. They volunteered because they felt that it would be a very good idea to lose some weight. Whatever you do to them, they are very motivated to lose weight. They would probably lose weight no matter what you did. It kind of reminds me of a colleague of mine. He was a scientist in the U.S., working for the Air Force, but he was also in Vietnam during the Vietnam War. And when I had a glass of beer or coffee, I don't remember the situation, with him, I said to him, John, many people who were in Vietnam, after they returned, they drank too much, they used drugs, you know, that war had a big influence on them. For various reasons, among others, the society didn't accept well the soldiers coming from Vietnam, like you probably saw in the movie Forrest Gump. They called them baby killers, while they were very often just good soldiers. In any case, I asked him that question, and he said to me, well, I suspect that, and I said, told him, you know, you're very successful as a scientist. And he said, well, probably those people who came back from Vietnam and started drinking alcohol or using drugs, they probably would drink alcohol or use drugs whether they went to Vietnam or not. It was a funny thing, kind of, you know, that statement. Just like here, you know, losing the weight, they would lose their weight no matter what you did to them. Natural process, essentially. They are motivated. They wanted to lose weight. And that was a natural process, they lost weight. So your conclusion that your methodology worked here would not be very justified. It's a big hole, you see. Maybe it worked, maybe not. But this design did not prove it. So you see that common sense, that's why you should use the common sense in experiments. Great, I'm out of time. We will continue with that. So thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.